Okay. So, welcome everybody. I think we've got a fascinating evening ahead of us. My name's Madeline, and I'm a columnist on The Guardian. And I have on my left Mark Williams, who's the Professor of Clinical Psychology at Oxford, and he set up the course on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And on my right is John, an old friend of mine, and the chair of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, who's going to take over as co-director of the course in October. So I'm delighted that the two of them have agreed to come to London to talk. The way we'll structure it is that each of them will sort of some introductory remarks for about 10 minutes or so, and then they're going to talk over a number of issues between each other, and I will chip in from time to time, perhaps. And then we'll open it up to yourselves. So please, if you have thoughts or comments or questions, please bear them in mind, because most of the second part of the session will be about involving you in a number of different ways. So we're very much looking forward to your contributions as well. I'm going to turn to Mark.
I think it was John first.
Oh, right. Okay. What's wonderful is that these two very good gentlemen have worked it all out. They told me exactly what's to happen this evening. That's excellent. So, John.
Okay. So I'll lead off. I want to make some remarks to begin with about the Buddhist tradition and the place of mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition. We've seen this explosion of mindfulness in the secular world, and we certainly see an acknowledgement of it having originated out of Buddhist sources. Now, the term mindfulness, let's take it back to its original language, is actually this term sati in Pali, or smriti in Sanskrit. And this term is probably the most frequently used term in the whole of the early canon of Buddhism. It's used far more than any other technical term in the canon. What we see in the early canon is a very highly nuanced understanding of what this thing that we call mindfulness is. The word sati, before I explore that with you, the word sati actually indicates, it's quite difficult, another conversation going on out there. The word sati actually indicates in Pali, indicates a process of recollecting something. It's actually derived from Sanskrit as well, where often this means memory, literally, in Sanskrit and Pali. And when we get this usage in the early texts, and this is really what I'm referring to in my little comments about Buddhism here, which is the early texts, when we see it referred to in the early texts, it's really referring to a quality of memory which takes place in the present moment. And so probably, it doesn't trip us off the tongue quite as easily as mindfulness, probably the term sati, this Pali term, is better translated as present moment recollection. This is probably the best translation. As I say, it's not as succinct as the term mindfulness. The term mindfulness, as many of you might know, was actually coined by the early translators of the Pali Canon, and it was derived directly out of the Christian Gospels, which is obviously what they knew in the 19th century. So they basically transplanted a lot of religious terms from Christianity into a Buddhist context, and this is where we get this translation of the term mindfulness. Now, when I say it's highly nuanced in the early canon, what I mean is that the Buddha basically presents many different versions of what mindfulness is. And he does this in usually lots and lots of different images that he offers of the function of mindfulness. So we get this plethora of images which are spread throughout the canon, which offer mindfulness in different roles. From some of the earliest parts of the canon, where actually mindfulness is considered to be friendliness. Yeah? There's a direct equation with mindfulness as being friendliness. So in the very early text, which is some of you might know, called the Metta Sutta, Metta, which is usually translated appallingly as loving kindness, actually means friendliness. It's derived from a Pali root, which means to grow fat with friendliness. You know, so it's actually a very, very nice term. But in the Metta Sutta, you get this referred to, is the Buddha says there is no greater mindfulness here, there is no better way to live in this world. So we get that form of mindfulness. And then classically, of course, and this is in many ways the template, certainly for much of the mindfulness that's taught in the West, is what is known as the four ways of founding mindfulness, satipatthana. Patthana meaning to found, to establish something. So these are four different elements of experience in which we can actually begin to establish mindfulness. Classically, in this very famous text, probably the most important meditational text in the whole of Buddhist canon, is this text called the Satipatthana Sutta, and there's many different versions of it. But the classic version is one which divides up mindfulness into four different functions, or four different elements of experience, which are ways of founding mindfulness. The first is the body. Now, these don't actually have to literally be taken in this order. In a lot of teaching, they are taken in this order, but they can actually be focused on in different ways. But the first is the body, which is called Kayanupassana. Kayanupassana is establishing mindfulness on embodied experience. This is such an important element of the early tradition in, again, another text which I could refer to in the numerical discourses. The Buddha says, he or she who is without mindfulness of the body has no mindfulness at all. And it's that important, this sense of bodily experience. So we're dealing with somatic experience here. And so there's a great deal of attention. In fact, in the Satipatthana Sutta, what we find is this attention that is paid to the body is the largest part of the text. Interesting, the part on mind is the smallest part of the text. So that's very interesting from the perspective of the way this was taught. So mindfulness of the body, the bulk of the text. Then we have mindfulness of something which is virtually untranslatable, which is this term called Vedana. Usually translated as feeling, which isn't a bad translation, but it doesn't actually capture what's going on, because this is what I would refer to as the hedonic tone of experience. How does it come to you? How does your experience come to you, particularly your physical experience? Does it come as pleasant? Does it come as unpleasant? Or does it come not as neutral as is often translated, but does it come as neither pleasant nor unpleasant in your experience? Equally, what is going on in the mind can also be seen in terms of pleasantness, unpleasantness, and neither. So we have these three elements of experience. So this is taking us into the field of what I call the tonality of our experience. How is our experience toned at any given moment? The third element, which is this word, which is citta, citta anupassana, which is the elements of our mind. It's often translated as mind, but actually in Pali and Sanskrit the word citta also has a meaning of heart as well. So it's actually an interplay between heart and mind. Many traditions, and this is carried through in most of the Buddhist traditions actually, it will refer to the quality of one's heart reflecting the quality of one's thinking as well. So there's something very, very important in this from this traditional perspective. Now we start to look here at how is this mind coloured? How is this mind at this moment? You can almost do this as an experiment. How is my mind at the moment? Is it dull? Is it awake? Is it desiring? Is it aversive? Is it contracted? Is it expansive? You know, and you've got this great list of how this mind is. And there's a little image that's used in one of the commentarial texts, which is actually how the mind is like taking some dye and dripping it into water. That dye will colour the whole of the water. It will seep out and pervade the whole of the water. Equally so, that a little bit of desire will colour the whole mind. Yeah. A little bit of aversion goes a long way. It will colour the whole mind. So we're looking actually at the general overall state of the mind. The fourth element, I'm kind of running up to concluding these sort of early remarks about the tradition, The fourth element, again, is a very difficult one. In fact, there's many different versions, as I say, of this Pali text. There's even a Chinese equivalent of it. And what we find is that there are really only two areas upon which they agree in the versions that we have. And so these are taken as probably being the originals. One is elements of the mind actually which are called generators of mental ill health. So this is about the contents of the mind. And this is not just about the overall colouring, it's about the actual contents. These generators of ill health and mental ill health are actually called, well, translated as hindrances. What their Pali term actually means is veiling. Veiling, like clothing something. So I take a cloth and I throw it over the microphone and I don't actually see the microphone, all I see is a vague outline of it. Because actually this is the way our minds are imprinting what we actually perceive. So we can imprint the world in five ways which are actually extremely unhelpful. Most of us will have experienced these, some of them multiply. Somebody I teach with, Christina Feldman, often refers to these as hindrance attacks, you know, where we get them all coming together. So you get, for example, you get sensual desire. Sensual desire might be the desire simply for a cup of tea, a biscuit. It doesn't have to be anything major, anything huge, it can be just something very simple. We get aversion. As I say, aversion goes a long way. We have aversive tendencies in the mind, they will arise. What I don't want at this moment in time. You know, what I don't want to be happening. You know, that loud noise out there, this uncomfortable chair or whatever it might be. Again, we're looking at aversion in, you know, covering a whole range of our experience. Then we get almost a switch-off mechanism. Beautifully translated in the old translations as sloth and torpor. The dynamic duo. Yeah, sloth and torpor here really is sleepiness and drowsiness. But this is not just ordinary sleepiness and drowsiness which comes through what I would call, you know, sort of mental hard work or physical hard work. It's actually the sloth and torpor or the sleepiness and drowsiness that arises as a way of avoidance. Now we see this particularly in meditation experiences, but we can see it in our ordinary life. When you've got too much on, the best thing to do is just switch off. And that's what the mind does. And so this is a way of switching off and not dealing with actual things that are arising. Then we have another duo, which is actually can be translated roughly as restlessness and remorse. Restlessness is that quality, if any of you have tried to do any prolonged meditation, you will see automatically. It's the body won't sit still. Have you noticed? Yeah. No matter how much you try to tell it, it won't sit still. People are kind of shuffling around, moving themselves, but the blanket's not quite right, and this isn't going properly, and actually the cushion isn't quite right, so I've got to get that right. And there's a kind of quality of restlessness to all the things that we're engaged in. Now we see that in our ordinary life, the way the mind is flitting from one thing to another. There is also worry or remorse which is coming up, and the remorse element is very much about, it's about, for example, things that have been said that shouldn't have been said, things that should have been done that shouldn't have been done, things that I might have done or I might have said. Yeah. Now, I don't know if any of this sounds familiar to any of you, but it's certainly what a lot of my mind does. And you know, we see this very, very clearly again in meditative experience, but we also see it when we start to look at the mind just in ordinary situations. Finally, there is what I call paralyzing doubt. Now, this is not doubt that is useful, that's questioning, but the doubt actually that will actually paralyze you from doing anything. And again, I think we can see that. Should I do this? Should I do that? Well, I can't see any good reason for doing this. I can't see any good reason for doing that. You know, perhaps this is better. Oh, no, that's quite better. You know, we get into the situation where, for example, the mind just can't operate and we can't make choices and even get on with doing things because of this sense of doubt. Now, this doubt, as I say, is either paralyzing doubt or skeptical doubt, and this is probably the best way of translating it. So these are your four foundations of mindfulness. You will find these scattered throughout the canon. Just to add in one final thing, that's the bad news about the mind. The mind also has other contents which are called supports of awakening. Now this process of within the tradition is about waking up. It's not about enlightenment, it's about actually waking up. and perhaps I'll say some more about that later. And what we find is there are factors which support this. Now, I'm running out of time, so I won't say them all, but I'll say the very first one that supports the waking up process is sati. And all of the others, in some senses, are there to support sati and are direct derivatives coming out of sati, coming out of this mindfulness. So mindfulness is put at the very pinnacle of the supports that encourage the awakening process. For us to wake up, actually, from what I call a sense of illness in this world, to waking up to a more healthy way of being in the world. And that's really what this traditional view is about. Now, as I say, it's highly nuanced. There are many, many images given, and perhaps some I might explore a few of those if we get time.
Thanks, John. Thank
you. Well. So, thanks very much indeed. And John took us on a really interesting journey from the foundational traditions through a sense of mindfulness actually being pivotal to those traditions. That's already, for many people in the clinical world, where I spend much of my time, or in the neuroscientific world, that's already important, because it already addresses some potential controversy about whether the mindfulness movement is itself a misunderstanding of some of the core of the foundational traditions. Whether John Kabat-Zinn made a big mistake, for example, when he called his work mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Maybe he should have kept it to stress reduction, and that everybody would have been happy, because he would have been able to use his Buddhist and his Zen roots and his yoga training, as he was, and then just not actually call anything that he was doing mindfulness. And it would have saved all of us a lot of bother, we might think. And then we hear John say, well, mindfulness, the translation of this word sati, however it's translated, is at the core of this 2,500-year-old tradition. That makes it really helpful for us, because we can say that there is some scholarship and some practice that we can draw on and anchor ourselves to as we do the clinical work and as we do the neuroscience that we need to do. And as you know, there's now a whole field of contemplative neuroscience, just in case you wanted longer phrases, more syllables. Contemplative neuroscience, it's a movement in mostly in the States, but it's coming to a place near you soon. We describe mindfulness meditation as training mental capacities, partly because in a secular context, in the National Health Service, for example, we probably wouldn't be able to use a term like sati or Buddhism. And perhaps that's a pity, but nevertheless, it does mean that we have to really be careful and cautious and mindful about how we present this, both to people who come to us for help, but also to managers in the health service who have a responsibility to do what is effective. There have been waves, of course, of meditation used in the West over the centuries, which has influenced religious traditions in particular, and the contemplative tradition within Christianity has been strong sometimes and weak sometimes. But usually you've had to go to a monastery to find it, and indeed, you've until 20 or 30 years ago, you had to go to a monastery to find Buddhism, until there was a wave of Zen coming to the West in the 50s and 60s, of transcendental meditation from a more Indian tradition in the 60s, and of course, it had a major boost when the Beatles got interested. The Daily Telegraph had a headline just a few months ago. Sorry to mention the Telegraph. The Telegraph had a thing. The Beatles were right. And then it qualified it by saying, you know, science shows meditation is helpful. And it's true, actually, that now we see the end point of research trials that were done on transcendental meditation in the 60s and 70s, because those people, there was one research trial, for example, on people suffering from hypertension who were over 55 years old in the 70s and 80s. Now, being 55 in the 70s and 80s, of course, now you can look 20, 30 years later and see how they got on, see whether they were randomly assigned to the TM group or not to the TM group. It turns out that the morbidity and mortality is vastly different in these groups. It turns out that it was incredibly useful for hypertension. And not only that, but lots of other diagnoses turned out to be less severe in the people that had meditated, or less likely to lead to death in the people that had been in that group. So quite striking findings, long-term findings. It's important that we don't sort of dismiss, just because something has gone out of fashion, and TM now isn't as fashionable as mindfulness, just because something's gone out of fashion, it doesn't mean that it actually hasn't been really helpful for people. One of the intriguing things then is, why didn't TM take over the scientific community quite as much as mindfulness is seeming to be doing? I think one of the reasons for that is because in those days, it was discovered fairly early on that deep relaxation, and there was a lot of that about in the 60s and 70s, because lots of behaviour therapists were learning and teaching deep relaxation. And it was found that actually the brain changes and the body changes that you get with TM were almost exactly simulated or repeated when you did deep relaxation. And so people very early started to say, so you don't need all this Eastern stuff then. You know, we just teach people to relax. We don't have to go to India, nor do we need a mantra, nor do we need this or that. And so part of the value of science, of course, is to be reductionist, to use Occam's razor and chuck out what we don't need. And so it rather left people saying, well, biofeedback and deep relaxation will do it all. However, interestingly, mindfulness doesn't seem to be producing that sort of scepticism. And I think the reason for that is a renewed interest in consciousness in science, and a renewed interest, therefore, in the first-person perspective that wasn't there in the heyday of behaviour therapy, when you'd measure the body and you'd measure how relaxed people were, but you wouldn't necessarily be very interested in the conscious experience. Now also we have a tool to study the brain when people are reporting different consciousnesses, and that's the functional magnetic resonance images, fMRI. You can see the brain in real time, which wasn't available then. And because neuroscientists are really interested in consciousness, they are much more open to talking to people who actually appear to have a handle on consciousness, on awareness, on compassion. And so you have Mathieu Ricard doing work with his colleague, with Richie Davidson, for example, in which they are wiring up monks or putting them in the scanner and seeing what happens when they meditate in the scanner. So that's one reason, I think, why the wave in the 50s and 60s perhaps was captured briefly by science. How valuable that was, and how we're only seeing its real value now, when 20 years, 30 years on, but how it passed, but how now there's been a sort of a coming together of science and clinical work and the Buddhist tradition in a way that is really beginning to flower. Whether it's flowering too proliferatorily, is that a word? Whether it's being too popular, and what are the gains and losses of such popularity, perhaps we could discuss later. There are anxieties about that, but just to reassure you, there's still plenty of people you meet who've never heard of mindfulness at all, just in case you want to be reassured. The world hasn't gone completely mad for mindfulness. What is its purchase on the National Health Service? And when I say purchase and National Health Service, I didn't mean to actually use that expression. But why is it of attraction? I think because of the centrality in the tradition of mindfulness on the one hand and dukkha on the other. Of suffering, no, not suffering dukkha, of discontent, of a dissatisfaction, of chronic dissatisfaction, which seems to be at the heart of what dukkha gets at. I've sat on John's feet for long enough to know that suffering is a rather bad translation and mistranslation. The sense of the dirt in the wheel, the grit in the oil that means that the wheel grinds as it goes round, the dirty place, the discontented place. And that the intriguing thing about mindfulness-based approaches to mental health is that it unites within a common theory and framework the discontent that the universe feels by being human, and the discontent that then turns out in people with bipolar disorder or depression or general anxiety or phobias or sexual dysfunction or all the things that take people to their doctor and end up with us psychologists. And I know many of you are therapists, and I recognise several psychologists here, so you know that the way in which psychology can, any of our psychology can go wrong because of our upbringing or our genes or some habit we get into that we can't escape from, can produce untold and inconsolable sorrow for people. Mindfulness speaks to that in an extraordinary way, because mindfulness shows up where sometimes compassion and love is the only thing left to do, when there's nothing else to be done. And interestingly, when compassion and love can be allowed to sit alongside suffering, something extraordinary can happen. But most of the time we dismiss love and compassion, and it never gets the chance to sit alongside our suffering. There's some times when, as to use a phrase of Francis Spufford in talking as recently in writing, that sometimes the only thing to do is to keep sorrow company. And that mindfulness can do that in a way that doesn't rush to change, and thereby allows people to see clearly the habits and patterns of their mind. And if in an 8-week program, which is originally developed by Kabat-Zinn, which he generously allowed us to use for our mindfulness-based cognitive therapy work, that puts dukkha at the heart, this chronic discontent, but is then available for us as a universal to meet our universal needs to find some consolation in our life rather than just in the life hereafter, but also allows it to deal with some serious mental health issues as well, and we'll perhaps come to those if people want to talk about that. And so coming right back to the Sati and Smriti, we see this present moment recollection that John talks about. We see the non-forgetfulness there. We see the sense of remembering the present there. And then we see the sense of compassion, which brings the ethical dimension, which we can talk about later if you wish, there too. The evidence is strong enough now for the NICE guidelines to include it as a treatment for repeated and recurrent depression. And when things get into NICE guidelines, that means that somebody somewhere has woken up to the possibility. And there are lots now trials on health anxiety, general anxiety, a trial on people who are already depressed rather than preventative depression. So lots of different trials there, and lots of science going on as well. But I think I've said enough for now, and let other people speak.
So, Donna, perhaps we could have you and Mark in a sort of dialogue for a while. There's the question of whether this fashion for mindfulness is leading to a sort of watering down, and anecdotally I think all of us, or many of us, will have examples which have slightly made us shiver. I remember a friend of mine, a colleague at The Guardian, said she'd booked into a £500 a day mindfulness course, and when she came back I said, how was it? And she said, it's great, I now know how to meditate. I've done that, she said, you know, so now I know, she said. So that is somewhat alarming, really, isn't it?
It is very alarming. I haven't quite heard of one as extreme as that. I mean, I think one of the things that worries people within the traditions is that mindfulness will be taken over as a money-making business. And there's a very severe danger of that. And I think people, particularly without real training in it and a lot of experience in it, will suddenly think there's a way to make money here. And I don't know whether this is one of those cases, but it's certainly making a lot of money out of it. And what has been interesting, of course, in the tradition is that this was for free. This was a capacity of the human mind that any of us could develop. And in many ways, and I've said this in many settings, and Mark's heard me say this many times before, is in many ways that mindfulness isn't Buddhist. You know, it's just that this tradition has concentrated on it. It's actually seen it as a faculty within human experience that can be developed to, you know, to help us with many of the problems which Mark outlined that we have, particularly this pervasive sense of dissatisfaction and discontent, which often runs through people's lives, which is the real meaning of this word dukkha. This was to be had for free. It was to be done with instruction, and it was something which was not there to make money. It was there within our experience, and we could actually develop it much further within our experience. So I think there's a great worry, I think, within practice communities that somehow this is now going to get co-opted into something very materialistic and taken away from something that was important within the traditions, which is the development of the human capacity.
Yeah. Sort of watering down a science. I mean, I find your talking, Mark, very interesting for the way it sort of combines scientific concepts and much more emotional ones about love and compassion is the only thing to do. How does that go down when you're talking to scientists?
Well, at least to scientists, there is a sort of level playing field, which is, can you see it? Can you measure it? That's a danger, of course. But can you see the evidence that that actually works? So, for example, in a trial done by Willem Kaiken, a research trial done by Willem Kaiken down in Exeter, to see whether mindfulness-based cognitive therapy was at least as good as antidepressant medication, because one strategy in science is to benchmark new treatments against accepted treatments. So in that trial, they allocated people randomly either to stay on their antidepressants — they'd all been on antidepressants for a while and were feeling quite good, so that the antidepressant seems to have worked. So some people stayed on their antidepressants for another year to 15 months. The other group actually were contracted to come off their antidepressants and to try mindfulness-based cognitive therapy instead. And they followed them all up, and the results in a nutshell was that it was as good as antidepressants, but on some measures it was actually better than antidepressants, which I don't surprise, won't surprise many people in this room. But that wasn't the point. The interesting point was, he also asked, what is it that's going on which determines whether it works or not? Mm-hmm. And he had measured self-compassion as one of the things. He'd also measured mindfulness. And it turned out the interesting pattern that both mindfulness and self-compassion changed during the MBCT, but of the both of them, there was slightly more evidence that change in self-compassion was one of the major psychological mechanisms by which people were protected from relapse. And what was even more interested in, he did a test in which he gave people, as we do sometimes, we ask people's permission, of course, to do this, but we expose them to 10 minutes of sad music. We use Prokofiev, Russia Under the Mongolian Yoke, played at half speed. And after 10 minutes of that, you feel pretty sort of a bit tired and dragged down. But interestingly, the reason why we do experiments with that is because it turns out that if you want to know who's vulnerable to another episode of depression, you can't just ask them. Because if you're feeling good right now, then none of these sort of depressive patterns of thinking actually come to mind. So, however, if you're feeling a bit drained, and the way to do that is to play Prokofiev for 10 minutes, especially if people are also thinking sad things from their past or reading sad things on a bit of paper, then they feel really down. And what's more, the patterns that were last evidenced when they were depressed start to be evident. They last about 5 minutes and then they disappear again. So in that 5 minutes, with people's permission, you can really discern what's going on and where they're vulnerable. Now, some people, after 10 minutes of Prokofiev, their patterns don't change at all. Other people get quite reactive. And what he found in his experiment was, after mindfulness, people could be reactive, but if they had learned compassion, that didn't play out over the next 12 months. Whereas if they were only on antidepressants, even though they were feeling fine, when they heard the Prokofiev, they reacted a bit, and the extent of their reaction predicted whether they would relapse over the next 12 months. So in the antidepressant group, they were still vulnerable, basically, and you could see that vulnerability just with a 10-minute little experiment. There it was in front of you, just for a moment. After mindfulness, you could see people would be reactive, but if they'd learned compassion, that then didn't play out over the next, they didn't get. So, yeah, it's a danger that in using words like love and compassion, people go, oh, yeah. But it turns out that you can see it in the brain, you can see it in clinical trials, and if people want to doubt it, they just have to read the literature.
Self-compassion, what's your sort of take on what Mark has just talked about? Would you say that in all of your teaching, self-compassion has been a major component?
Well, it certainly has. I mean, over the last probably about 8 years or so, I mean, two focuses of my own teaching practice has been either retreats which concentrate on metta karuna, which is basically this friendliness and compassion, or on mindfulness. And one of the things actually I was saying last week when I was at Guy House and teaching was actually they're not two different things. They're actually the same thing that we're talking about. So when we're talking about doing insight meditation, we're talking about doing basically self-compassion in a different way. If we're talking about doing self-compassion, we're talking about doing insight meditation. Yeah, these are not two different things. I don't think they were ever intended to be two different things. And so when I look at, again, when I kind of do more scholarly work and look at some of the early texts, I see this very clearly in the early texts, that the Buddha isn't giving us two completely different realms of experience. He's actually talking about how we relate to ourselves. And again, something I was just saying last week is just the very act of turning towards what is difficult in our lives in itself is an act of friendliness. Just that very act, of looking at what is arising as difficulty in our lives rather than trying to avoid it or cover it over and all of the usual strategies that we engage in, just that very act itself, that just basic act of turning towards and standing close to for a little while, that in itself is friendliness. And out of that will grow the compassion too. So this is absolutely central to the teaching. It's not something separate.
I'm just wondering whether there is something about Western culture, or whether it's a universal human condition, that self-compassion is not something that is sort of intuitive, innate. I mean, is there something particularly about Western culture and the way it's developed that it makes self-compassion such a difficult thing to grasp?
Well, I think the problem is actually telling people to be compassionate doesn't quite work. And there's a lot of telling in Western culture and a lot of sort of intellectualization, a lot of reading books about things. And I like it when people read books, especially depending on what they are. But I'm not against books. But they're only fingers pointing to the proverbial moon and so on. And the question is that what often we've lost in Western culture is the practice. And that's what you could have got from the monastery. And probably by the 16th century, the monasteries deserved to be closed down by all accounts. They were more into growing wine than they were into anything else, I think. But I think if it hadn't been for Henry VIII, we'd still have Rivo Abbey, and we'd still have those places which are now mounds in the grass. And possibly there would have been a Reformation, and there would have been monks there to teach us. Now, of course, retreat houses, sometimes secular, sometimes Buddhist, and even some of the monasteries that are left are opening their doors and having guest rooms that you can go. And even the BBC have got interested in Channel 4, haven't they, in the big silence and in the monastery and so on. There's a sense of intrigue, being intrigued by the monastic life. And the central thing about that is practice, not telling. And that's the thing.
What do you think about that, John? Is it a particularly sort of Western phenomenon, this kind of need for self-compassion?
I think it's far greater in the West. I mean, Eastern teachers, when they first came to the West and started teaching things like the metta practice, when traditionally in the metta practice and this friendliness practice, the first object of metta or friendliness is yourself. They were absolutely astonished how difficult Western people found this. This was taken in the East as being something you did for a very short period of time before moving on to the other categories, like difficult people. Yeah, and things like that. And so the practice actually got modified in the Western context to spend a great deal of time actually trying to generate just friendly thoughts towards yourself, engaging in what I call behavioural gestures of the mind towards yourself, which are friendliness. Now, I think a lot of it probably does go back to Protestantism, self-critic, the swallowing of the self-critic, which I think is still a huge part of Western culture. I mean, so much so that we turn that inner critic into a virtue because, you know, I can be as critical of you because I'm being as critical of me. You know, basically it's saying I can beat you up because I can beat me up. And I think that a lot of that goes on in the West, and it does seem to be a primary, very much more within the Western context than within the Eastern context. I don't want to romanticise these because I think they have their own problems as well, but this isn't one of them, actually.
Yeah. And I think that one of the most common things that mindfulness teachers ask about in supervision and so on is whether they're doing it right, whether they're teaching it right. And mindfulness people in the group, am I doing it right? And it's sort of like, well, it's a legitimate question to ask about whether there are any technical supports that actually are available. But often doing it right has this image, it has this sort of... There's a little devil that creeps in that tells you you're probably not doing this right and you're not getting the full benefit. So there's a sort of bias both in our as mindfulness practitioners and as mindfulness teachers. There's a sort of, to reflect what John's just said, a sort of Calvinistic mindfulness, which is I've got to do my practice, and it's very important. Well, yeah, it is. There's a certain sort of effort and persistence with practice, as we discover, and it goes up and down, and awareness seems to disappear, or it comes back, and it's a real gift when it comes back, and when it's got an ease. There's something, as a spiritual director friend of mine says about practicing, which is just, to use an expression from the first Karate Kid film, wax on, wax off. Wax on, wax off. There's something about just doing it. Wax on, wax off, which he is, as a spiritual director, he uses with his Christian, in Christian formation. I think they think he's a bit strange, but I think also very wonderful and loving. But I think there's something about that. But that gives a slightly different feel from, you've got to do this, and there's a way of doing it right, and if you're not getting the full benefit if you don't do it in the right way. And that, I think, can pervade all our best intentions if we're not careful, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a correlate to that as well, if you don't mind me saying this. I think there's a correlate to that, is that for a lot of Western practitioners, when they first start being involved in this, it becomes a pretty joyless business, actually. It's something they have to. It's just another thing you have to do. You know? Meditation is good for you. You have to do it. And it's a fairly joyless business at that. Now, joy... I didn't mention it, but you know, when I said there were seven factors which actually supported the awakening process, the waking up process, well, one of the factors is joy. This is a really, really important dimension to it. And actually, I think a lot of spiritual practice, both historically and even in the contemporary world, can be a fairly joyless business in the Western world. You know, there's not a lot of levity to it. Now, the amount of times I've been in Buddhist monasteries and seeing people falling around laughing, particularly when they get things wrong.
We were talking about gains and losses, and you talked about the commercialisation of mindfulness. Is there a danger of kind of losing the subtlety? Because a lot of the sort of Buddhist teaching is quite carefully nuanced and has the added complication that it's been very badly translated.
Yeah.
Repeatedly. So one's always kind of fighting through a thicket of mistranslations.
Mm.
Now, how can one ensure that it gets transmitted now in a way that is actually kind of faithful?
I think it's a big question, actually, because one of the dimensions that's involved in that is we have to look at what's going on in the Buddhist path from a traditional point of view is not just being about meditation. Meditation is one of the components, but it isn't just about meditating. It's not, the Buddha is not saying sit on a cushion and everything will become right in the world. He's saying sometimes you actually just have to go out and change your life. You actually have to do things. Particularly you have to look very closely at your ethics. Look at your ways of living in terms of your morality. Which is obviously not something, is not a message that particularly in the clinical world is one that would be spoken about. Whereas in the Buddhist world, this is very, very clear. I mean, one famous commentator actually says without this dimension of looking at the ethical, actually the mindfulness part of it is a complete waste of time. Mm-hmm. You that it's actually grounded in ways of being. And if you somehow see that your way of being in the world is destructive, then actually you need to change that. Sometimes we've spoken a little bit here about compassion and kindness and friendliness. Sometimes those are not going to automatically arise as lovely feelings. Sometimes you have to go out and behave in a more friendly way, behave in a more compassionate way. So there's a huge behavioural component with this as well. What the Buddha was trying to present was a complete, I know it's a bit clichéd, and I wouldn't really want to reduce it to this, but what the Buddha was trying to present was a complete way of life, not just a technique to deal with certain pathologies, basically. You know, he's looking at, if you like, a big pathology, which is life. And all the difficulties that that involves for us. Some which happen to us, inevitably, and some which we create for ourselves. And it's particularly the latter which he's dealing with, although it helps you to deal with the former as well.
It's quite challenging, isn't it, Mark? It's not a technique. The NHS probably feels a bit edgy about this.
The NHS probably thinks it is a technique.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are techniques there, but I mean, I think one of the questions is, in what context is the health service doing this? And interestingly, most of the time, the health service is doing this as part of, the modern word is packages of care. It doesn't particularly sound very nice, does it? But it's a sort of a sense of caring for the person. One of the problems about the NHS is how they divide up a person, you know, into this arm, that arm, this body, this, you know, the urinary system is different from the head and so on. Which it is, I do agree, but it's, just remembering my O-level biology, you're all right, O-levels are coming back, we'll all know about it soon. The sense of, but actually the behavioural element, of course, the holistic element is already there within, or should be there. For example, if you go to a cognitive behaviour therapist, to most therapists, they will, and people don't come often for mindfulness until they've been through a lot of different therapies. But often, if you're a good cognitive therapist will look at all the behaviour that is being done and look to see what is, well, if you use different terms, what is wholesome and unwholesome. What is tripping people up? What habits of behaviour are tripping people up? And work on that, and get people even to keep diaries. I mean, people do a lot of diary keeping in this sort of cognitive behavioural thing, so that people can look themselves and see what is the anatomy of their lives at the moment, both in terms of what they're doing they didn't even think they were doing. Perhaps they thought they were doing nothing all day, but actually doing nothing can be, there can be a lot of things written down on people's diary. It might be they think they're doing nothing, but actually doing too much. Or they think they're doing nothing, but they are doing a lot, they're just not enjoying it. So you begin to discern with people in a collaborative way this behavioural, this what might be called an ethical element, in that ethics is about dwelling in the world and dwelling with other people. So what are your relationships like? So a lot of therapy is about that behaviour and the way we dwell in the world. We just don't call it that. We don't name it that. By the time people come for mindfulness, then often they've done a lot of that, but they particularly want help with the entanglements of the mind, which can sometimes be addressed by mindfulness by saying, well, let's step out of the mind and step into the body, for example. And that takes some effort, it takes some training, but once you've trained people in attention, then there's a chance they might, having grounded their attention, to see what the patterns of the mind are, and it seems to be very helpful for people. Also, it's interesting that when people do, they come for mindfulness as part of their therapy sometimes, but they discover that it's affecting all other aspects of their lives. They can find themselves being naturally more compassionate, as Willem Kaiken has found in his research, but we see it every day in the clinic as well, that people discover something about themselves and sometimes about the people with whom they share their lives that they haven't considered. And they might, you know, be very angry with a colleague at work, but suddenly find themselves, without any apparent effort or trying to rethink anything, they see them as perhaps a bit lonely or a bit sad. And that changes the whole perspective on them. I think, well, where did that come from? I haven't been to therapy, a loneliness therapy, or I haven't talked about my colleague in the class, but something's bubbled up here. So I think we see mindfulness as part, within the health service, as part of what people are offered, They're offered behavioural and cognitive and other work to work on other aspects of their lives. So, so to some extent, that's being addressed. And also within the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, other things bubble up. People start maybe as a technique, but then they're not so sure anymore as it begins to spread into other areas of their lives. Yeah.
John, I was wondering whether now would be a good moment for you to lead us in 10 minutes meditation. So instead of talking about all this, we actually experience some of it.
Okay. Well,